Im freien Senderkombinat folgt nun der vierte und vorerst letzte Teil der Diskussionsreihe aus dem Hamburger Gängeviertel. Wir gestalten die Stadt, in der wir leben wollen, aber wie? Am 19. Februar 2011 war das Londoner Lab of AI für einen Workshop zu kreativen Widerstand und für einen Vortrag im Gängeviertel. Letzterer wurde für FSK aufgenommen und ist in den nun folgenden 2 Stunden zu hören. Moderiert von Hanna Kowalski referierte John Jordan zur Kunst der direkten Aktion, begleitet von diversen Videoprojektionen. Im Anschluss folgte eine Diskussion mit dem Publikum. Beides wurde in englischer Sprache abgehalten. In der Ankündigung der Veranstaltungsreihe heißt es: Mit der Besetzung des Gängeviertels ist ein unverhoffter Möglichkeitsraum mitten in Hamburg entstanden. Die Initiative Komm in die Gänge und tausende Hamburgerinnen haben die Stadt zum Rückkauf des historischen Viertels bewogen. Die 12 Häuser sind ein Versuch, selbstorganisierte künstlerische Praxis mit der Kritik an sozialer Ungleichheit in der Stadt zu verknüpfen. Die derzeitige Stadtregierung hat diesen Versuch zunächst akzeptiert. Seit Monaten verhandelt diese nun mit der Initiative über die zukünftige Entwicklung. Die Initiative möchte das Gängeviertel als kulturellen und politischen Ort erhalten. Das Gängeviertel muss ein öffentlicher Ort werden, an dem soziale und stadtgesellschaftliche Aufgaben verhandelt und angegangen werden. Es ist geplant, dass große Teile des Viertels als soziokulturelle Flächen von vielen Hamburgerinnen genutzt werden und sozialverträglicher Wohn- und Arbeitsraum entsteht. Doch diese Zukunft des Gängeviertels ist noch lange nicht gesichert. Das Recht auf Stadt muss hier, wie an vielen anderen Orten, von handlungswilligen Menschen Tag für Tag aktiv gestaltet und gegen viele Interessen durchgesetzt werden, die einer gerechteren, urbanen Zukunft entgegenstehen. Die Weiterführung der Diskussionsreihe im Gängeviertel fragt nach Handlungsoptionen, Beweggründen und Zielsetzungen dieser Menschen. Wie können Freiräume erhalten und der profitmaximierten Verwertung durch den Immobilienmarkt entzogen werden? Sind die zumeist prekären Arbeitsverhältnisse sogenannter Kreativer eine Chance für den gesellschaftlichen Wandel oder Zwang zur Selbstausbeutung im Sinne neoliberaler Wirtschaftspolitik? Welche Möglichkeiten gibt es, erfolgreichen Widerstand zu praktizieren, ohne letztendlich vom Unternehmen Stadt instrumentalisiert zu werden? Menschen aus Hamburg und weiteren europäischen Großstädten berichten von ihren Erfahrungen und Beobachtungen und alle sind herzlich eingeladen, mit zu diskutieren. Konkret heißt es weiter: Das Londoner Kollektiv Lab of AI hat uns im Sommer 2010 im Rahmen eines Festivals dazu eingeladen, mit Fahrrädern auszuschwärmen und den städtischen Raum Hamburgs anzueignen. Nun kommt die Gruppe, die seit Jahren mit Formen des zivilen Ungehorsams experimentiert, zurück ins Gängeviertel. Im Workshop sollen anhand unserer Erfahrungen rund um die Recht auf Stadtbewegung Möglichkeiten kreativer, eingreifender Praktiken erörtert werden. Wie kann man konventionelle Protestformen durchbrechen, um den Raum zwischen Kunst und Aktionismus subversiv zu nutzen? Unser Referent John Jordan ist Mitbegründer des Kollektivs Reclaim the Streets 1995 bis 2000, der Clandestine Rebel Clown Army sowie Mitherausgeber des Buches Wir sind überall, weltweit, unwiderstehlich, antikapitalistisch, das im Nautilus Verlag erschienen ist. Momentan engagiert er sich in der Klimacamp-Bewegung und hat gemeinsam mit Isabelle Fremont das Buch Path Through Utopia geschrieben, das im Februar in französischer Sprache erscheinen wird. Ja, soweit die Ankündigung. Wir wünschen nun anregendes Hören bei dem englischsprachigen Vortrag Die Kunst der direkten Aktion mit anschließender Diskussion.
So, thank you for your patience and I'm glad that all of you are there. This is the last event of our series of talks about Metropole. We started with a talk with the Flora, where we already talked a lot about different forms of activism, about more conventional forms, about creative activism, and I'm very glad that today we can connect to that first talk about activism. Today with John Jordan, where I'm very happy that he's here tonight, and very happy that we already did a workshop today with him. There's some organizational stuff. First of all, there's no smoking during the talk. afterwards, we were very glad if you smoke a lot, but right now, please stop. Everyone who has a cigarette puts it out. And then there's another organizational thing. That is that because we're glad that we got some money from the Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung and we need like an attention list, like who's been attending to the thing, but you don't have to put your name in it, but you can. So it's free. We'll be glad to. I just give it around. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the organizational stuff. And otherwise, I'm just very, very, very glad that John Jordan from London, who is part of the collective of Lab of II, is here tonight. I met him in Kampnagel this summer at a workshop, and he did a bike action, or his group, Lab of II, did a bike action coming from Kampnagel to Gängeviertel to the Elbphilharmonie last summer on the 24th of August was that. So we're happy to see each other again and to connect to that experience. And I think now I'll pass on to you and give you the word.
Thanks. So thank you, everyone, for hanging around. And a handful of tactics against representation of the artistic and the political kind. So I'm going to just go through 11 tactics that have been useful. Can you hear well with this? Yeah. That have been useful for the kind of work I've been doing and the collectives I work with have been doing. So I was trained in theatre and then I was trained in fine art. Now, theatre was a great training because it taught me some terrible things. It taught me that art and life should be separate. That especially, it's really good that there's a stage that separates the experts from the audience. And whatever happens, even if the world is falling around, the audience must stay in their seats. So it taught me a lot of things about the culture of separation we have, this idea that we separate everything in capitalism.
What do you think?
Oh my God.
I knew it was going to happen.
It's wonderful.
Were you happy?
Yeah.
Were you able to get it? Did you get it?
I think so.
All right.
That was a big one.
So that's called glacier calving, and rich American tourists go on big boats into the Arctic and they watch the glaciers melt. So we're living in a culture of exponential curves, and every day I watch the curves kind of go up. So whether they're curves that talk about global temperature, or whether they're curves that talk about the depletion of the soil, or whether they're curves that talk about the depletion of water, or the acidification of the seas, or the gap between rich and poor, they keep going up, and up, and up. And we all know that what happens at the end of an exponential curve, it always crashes. So above where I work in London, I have this postcard that was produced in a collective I worked with in the 1980s, and it says, "The question of art is no longer one of aesthetics, but the survival of the planet." So what is aesthetics? Well, aesthetics, for me, it comes from the Greek. It means aesthesis. It means to sense the world, to feel it, to literally feel it in your stomach, to actually understand and feel the world with your guts. When I was 14, my father died of skin cancer. And being a 14-year-old boy, I didn't really want to feel anything. So my mother was going, you know, how are you feeling? You need to talk to someone. I wouldn't talk to anyone, and eventually she took me to the doctor because, you know, it's good to see an expert in those situations. So they took me to the doctor, and I sat opposite the doctor on a desk, and the doctor said, "So, John, how are you feeling?" So I opened my mouth, and I projectile vomited across his oak desk. And I sometimes wish I could still feel like that. So when I was a bit older, I did art college, and I got into performance art, and I got into body art. And so I did all the things that body artists do. I took my clothes off. I cut myself. I, you know, did all those things, thinking that I was making radical art. And I was doing it in galleries, and then I thought, no, it's not radical enough. I maybe have to go and do it outside. So I started to do the same things in the street, thinking, I'm in the public space now. It's definitely radical art. Trouble is, everyone didn't think it was art at all. They thought I was simply mad. And even if they did kind of begin to think it was art, they would just talk about the fact that it wasn't art, and we'd have a discussion about what is art and what isn't art, which was not what I was interested in. I was interested in making art that somehow talked about society, about change. So this taught me the first tactic, which for me is called the invisibility trick. So Jean Dubuffet wrote, "Art loves to be incognito. Its best moments are when it forgets what it is called." And I soon realized that actually art gets in the way. Very often it gets in the way of what you want to talk about, of what you want to create, of what you want to really do. And so I started to make the art invisible. So in the 90s, I was doing a lot of projects where actually it was completely invisible that it was art. So this was a project on a buried river, an urban buried river, where there are 75 buried rivers in London. And so we set up a fake development agency to dig up the river, to say, we're going to go and dig up the river, and this is what it's going to look like. And we work with architects to create models of what the river would look like. And we pretended we were an urban development agency. No one knew it was art. And the story really started to spread in the media and so on in the area. And then I did other projects. I did a whole series of projects about men's relationship to, or heterosexual men's relationship to pornography. This is me a long time ago, without Photoshop. I did a whole project where, for example, I set up a fake sex shop in a town centre which again was invisible as art. So all these tactics, and I haven't got time to talk about them now, but all these tactics were really about making art invisible. Trying to do the same process, but making the art invisible. Because for me, art isn't a noun. It's not a thing. It's a verb. It's the way of doing something. It's much more about the process and the behavior and that we apply to something. So then, when I was about... in 1993, I had my life changed. And I jumped over a wall during a protest against an urban motorway that was going to knock down 350 houses, destroy three woodlands, just to save 7 minutes on a car journey. Of course, once the road was built, those 7 minutes weren't even saved because the traffic had increased, because it took 40 years to plan and build the road. So there was loads of protest against it, and one of the protests was direct action. And for me, this was the first time I'd taken direct action. I jumped over a wall, and I jumped onto a bulldozer, and I stopped the bulldozer with people, and I suddenly thought, hang on, this is really similar to the performance art that I used to be interested in. You know, these are people's bodies in public space, taking action with an element of risk, but actually it's really real. It's really pragmatic. It's stopping the bulldozers, and it's costing the government money, and in the end, that movement in England cancelled about 700 road schemes. So for me, it was the best kind of theatre. in a way, it was theatre which had budgets much better than the Royal Opera House, in fact. Because the Royal Opera House could never afford policemen on horses, a whole forest. And so for me, I suddenly realised this was much more interesting theatre. And it was beautiful. I mean, really, there were many tree houses and so on, and really there was an incredible poetry to a lot of the stuff. The trouble is, in many ways, by getting involved in the direct action movements, and that's what I did, I basically threw myself into the direct action movements and started to work within them. I did what Susie Gablik, who is a cultural theorist, she calls the art world the prison of the art world. So I did manage to escape the prison of the art world, but I did spend a bit more time in the cells of the prisons of the real world. This is me being arrested as a clown. When they arrested me, they actually said I was a 22-year-old female, which was great because I was 44. And when you disobey in the art world, in a sense, you get you're celebrated. You get onto the front of the art magazines. You get to go to biennials. You've changed the form. When you disobey in the real world, it's a very different matter. You end up getting police records, being followed. It's a very, very different situation. This is the front page of The Guardian recently. This is me here, as a domestic extremist, which I think is really unfair because I am very bad at ironing. I didn't go, that joke. It's an English joke. Okay, domestic extremism, ironing. No? Okay. All right, it's a bad joke. Never mind. I try. But the thing is that in a way, the difference between the art world and the social movements for me is the element of solidarity. So here, I might be here, but I'm actually surrounded by my friends here, and friends who basically are all incredibly creative but would never call themselves artists. They all put all their passion and all their creativity into social movements but never would want to call themselves artists. So that's the invisibility tactic. The second tactic, give up representation. So I think the art world is obsessed by representation. It's an illness. And they find it really hard to shake off. For me, what I learned from direct action was that direct action was actually about taking action that directly changed the thing you wanted to change. It wasn't about asking someone, writing a letter to a politician, making a demonstration saying, we want this. It was going and doing it, like squatting the Gangavital. It was going to do the thing you want to do directly, to make the change directly. So for me, art, the best art, was surely doing the same. Surely the role of art was to transform the world, not to represent it. I didn't want to make pictures of politics. I wanted to actually change the world. Now, most artists who get involved in social movements end up kind of designing flyers and doing the propaganda and the communications, which is fine. And I've done that too. This is something I recently did for the climate camp in London. But really, for me, that's not the key. I think artists have a lot more to give to social movements than just designing their posters. I think there is an incredible creativity that is necessary within social movements. Because the trouble is, most social movements, most politics, to be honest, is pretty boring. You know, it's like marching from A to B with a placard which says no. It's newspapers, it's long, long consensus meetings. It's really, really dull. But what's in that space is courage. It's people who really have the courage to break the law, the courage to actually put their bodies on the line, and they don't have the egos that the artists have. And for me, that's why the space that is most interesting to create is to create a space where the imagination of the artist and the courage and the social critique of the activists come together. Because in the end, I think the challenge is we have to make radical social movements as sexy as capitalism. And that's not easy. Stephen Duncombe wrote in a book, a great book called Dream, Reimagining Progressive Politics in an Age of Fantasy. And he wrote, "Politics is not solely or even primarily about reasoned thinking and rational choices. It's an affair of fantasy and desire. People are rarely moved to action, support, or even consent by realistic proposals. They're motivated by dreams of what could be." Dreams of what could be. How do you make politics about the dreams of what could be? So we come to tactic number three, which is reclaiming the spaces of possibility. So I was very lucky in the 90s to be involved in a movement called Reclaim the Streets. It began around 1995. And the whole idea of Reclaim the Streets was this idea of prefigurative politics, to create a politics that looks like the world that you want to create, so that every action in itself is a kind of image, a model, where you can feel or sense some of the possibilities of what the world that you want is or could be like. So Reclaim Street started in 95. The idea was that streets are the commons. Does commons make any sense to people when they say the word commons? That the street is a common. It's a common that has been privatized by urban development, but specifically privatized by shops and by cars. That the car itself privatizes the street. And if you look at a lot of sociology and urban studies, you can see that the more cars in the street, the less neighborhood connections, the less people talk amongst themselves in a neighborhood. And so the idea was to reclaim the street as a common, as a place where people could talk, as a place where people could live, as a place where people could create a sense of neighborhoodliness. So what we would do is we would normally meet in a... We would use tactics from rave culture. So it was a real mixture of rave culture, anarchist culture, ecologist culture, and other social movements. And we would do what rave cultures did at the time, where you would meet in a point which was public, and then the actual street that we were going to reclaim was secret, and a few people knew. And we would basically take the metro, go down the metro, and in those days the police radios didn't work in the metro, and this was the first one. So we what happened is on Camden High Street in North London, these two cars were kind of driving up the street, and suddenly the two cars crashed into each other. And people got out of the cars and started to shout, scream, and have like road rage. "What the fuck? Well, you hit my car!" Da, da, da. And then one of them opened the boot of their car, and out of their car they brought hammers and they started to attack their other car. And then the other person took out of their boot a load of paint and started throwing paint over their car. And at that moment, 500 people came out of the tube station, jumped on the cars, put the banner up, and of course they were our cars. It was a blockade to block the road from the traffic. And the street party happened. And the street party idea was really politics has to be about pleasure. That, you know, as Brecht knew, we can't change the world unless we make it the most pleasurable activity that we do. It has to be something that creates passionate desire in many ways. So we would, the street party would be like a carnival. We'd be reclaiming the space. And we would do things like... A few years later, the street parties started to happen. They started to happen all over Europe, Berlin. There was some. I don't know if were there ever in Hamburg. Maybe I don't know. Yeah, there was. Yes, there were some in Hamburg. And so in London, we started to get a bit over ambitious, and we thought, shit, we've done streets. Let's do a motorway. So we decided to do the shortest motorway in London, which is the M41. And this is after the government had already made rave music illegal in Britain. It was actually illegal to play rave music to more than five people in public. But they didn't stop us. So we took a motorway. 8,000 people took the motorway. And we covered the motorway in sand so that children could play in the sand as a sand pit rather than being killed by the cars. And another thing on during this street party that we did is that we had these very large dresses that these kind of puppets that went up and down and with real people at the top. Normally they had wigs on, but she's under underpass, so she had to take her wig off. And they would move up and down, and every now and then they would stop by a sound system. And if you listened very carefully, you could hear a kind of rumble under the skirts. And what was happening is there were people under the skirts with jackhammers digging into the motorway and planting trees. And this taught me another great tactic, which was the importance of myth making. And again, artists are really brilliant at creating myths and creating stories. And the world changes through stories, more than facts, more than figures. It changes through telling good stories. And this story of the trees being planted in the motorway, it was the early, it was 1997, I think. So it was early days of the internet, and it started to spread across the internet really, really rapidly. And managed to get people interested in very different movements, and was, in a sense, one of the beginnings of the coming together of the early days of the ultra-globalization movement, because we then got contacted by people like the Liverpool Dockers, who were like a trade union movement of dockers, very traditional left, who would normally never work with kind of anarchists and ravers and ecologists, and actually yet came together because of the imagination, because their imagination had been touched by this story, and they were like, wow, we want to work with these people. So again, it showed that imagination, whoops, can really break down those boundaries. Okay, tactic number four, make the material your movement. No, make the material the... Oh, yeah, okay. I think I might have written that wrong. Anyway, make the material the movement. Let's go back a bit. 1871, Paris. It's the Commune. The Commune happens. The people of Paris, the kind of poor of Paris, the outcasts, organize, and they basically, together with kind of the class of journalists and so on, and they take back Paris, and they try and create the least representation possible. They try and create a city which is as directly democratic as possible. It terrifies the bourgeoisie, and many escape, especially the artists. So Manet, Cézanne, Monet, what do? They don't stay in the Commune, they run away. They go to the suburbs, they go to the country, and they take refuge from the politics. But one artist stayed, Gustave Courbet, the kind of inventor of social realism, the first artist who had the nerve to paint the poor, who refused to paint the rich and painted the poor. And he basically saw the Commune as an extraordinary historical moment and thought, I'm not going to represent the Commune. I'm not going to paint paintings of the Commune. I'm actually going to get involved. I'm actually going to apply my creativity. I'm going to put my paintbrushes down and I'm going to apply my creativity to the Commune, to actually building the Commune, to actually being an artist with the canvas of the city and the social movement in that city. And he, one of the actions of creativity that he designed was the pulling down of the Vendôme Column. So this is 1871, not so long ago, really. This was a monument to imperialism. It had Napoleon on the top. It was made from melted down Prussian artillery. And they had a huge party in the square, and they pulled the Vendôme Column, which was this symbol of hierarchy and pyramidical power, when what they wanted was horizontality. And it fell, and Courbet had to... The Versailles army came in, 25,000 or 30,000 people were killed, men, women, children, within 2 days on the streets of Paris. Courbet went into exile and died in exile. He was forced to pay for the rebuilding. But what's interesting is just afterwards, the Impressionists came and a few years later had their first exhibition. So they'd run away and then they came back, and in a way they aestheticized revolt, because their form was a revolt. You know, people described Impressionism as paintings made by throwing stones. And yet, actually, all they were doing were representing the bourgeoisie and bringing back the idea of Paris as a bourgeois city. And so, for me, the lesson there was Courbet used the movement as his material. He put down his paintbrushes and used the movement as his material. Number five, crafting frames that enable creative chaos. So Reclaim the Streets got really bigger and bigger, And then we started to work with lots of the global movements in the 1990s and the People's Global Action. And we started to do things which were global days against capitalism. And this was the first carnival against capitalism. And it happened in about 100 cities. And in London, what we did is we created a carnival in the financial district, because the call out was to do carnivals in the financial district to replace the sound of profit with the sound of pleasure. And one of the projects there that I was involved in was what I would call creating a frame. Because within political movements, as an artist, quite a lot of artists are control freaks. You know, they like to control every single little bit, and they know if it's this or this, and they, you know, absolute control freaks of detail. You can't do that in a social movement, because social movements need spontaneity, they need creative chaos. So what's really interesting is to create frames, very, very beautiful crafted frames, and within that frame, those frames will enable creative chaos to happen. So the frame that we created here was actually partly a solution to a problem. We knew that everyone was going to meet at this one railway station in Liverpool Street. It was on a Friday. It was a work day. We knew the police would try and stop us moving. They would try and shut down the tube stations, or they would try and stop us moving in some way. So what we decided to do was we made 8,000 of these masks, and there were four different colors: red masks, green masks, black masks, and gold masks. And on the back of the mask was a text. And the text was a kind of, you know, very poetic text about the role of finance capitalism, the role of the mask in carnival, the fact that CCTV cameras try and get our faces and yet the faces of those in charge of financial capital are invisible, blah, blah, blah. And then on the bottom it said, "On the signal, follow your colour, let the carnival begin." So the idea of the tactic was that we would pass the masks out to four corners of the station. So the red ones in one corner, the green ones in the other, the black ones in the other, the gold ones in the other. And the people passing them out had little flags of various colours in their pocket. On the signal, which was meant to be this Mission Impossible sound, Mission Impossible tune played from a sound system that kind of doom, doom, doo, doo, doom, doom, doo, doo, doom. Unfortunately, there were too many people and no one could hear it. So we had to send a firework up. But on that signal, basically, the people got their flags out of their pockets and went off into four different ways, and the crowd followed. So the red people with red masks went one way, the people with green masks went the other, black the other. And it created what was then called by the police report afterwards a starburst effect, which they couldn't actually control at all. Their hierarchy collapsed at that minute. They didn't know what to do. And we were able to get to the London International Financial Futures Exchange, which is like a big exchange for futures speculation. We managed to open up where there used to be a buried river. We managed to kind of symbolically open the water and get a shoot of 100-meter water in the air. And people were making love in the water. The water was flooding into the stock exchange and shutting down the stock exchange. There was £10 million worth of damage done to the city that day. And the front page of the Financial Times said, "Anti-capitalist besieged city of London," which was pretty good, really. And at the same time, it was happening all over the world. And it was 6 months before Seattle. So it was really the kind of precursor to the ultra-globalization movement. And many people from Seattle were involved in it in some ways and heard about it. And it really inspired people in Seattle. This was the action that took place in Nigeria at exactly the same time. And they called it the Carnival of the Oppressed and so on. So tactic number five. Liberate the disobedient body. So in about 2003, I had a really stupid idea. The idea was to set up a thing called the Clandestine Insurgent Rebel Clown Army. So the idea was to use the clown, the idea of the clown, that is a naturally disobedient body. The clown is the kind of archetype of disobedience. It's an archetype that everyone understands. And I think it's very interesting to use archetypes in politics. Obviously, you've got to be really careful. Especially in Germany, I understand that's an issue. But I think the Zapatistas are an interesting example. The Zapatistas' use of the mask. The mask is an archetype in Mexico. Everyone understands what a mask is, what a mask means, and their use of the mask has been incredibly successful. So I felt the clown was a kind of European archetype as well. Everyone understands a clown. And the clown also, in a way, has been restricted. The disobedience has been put into the horrible children's parties or the circus or the theatre. And the clown, as this real disobedient character, has been kind of flattened. So the idea was to take back that disobedience and to also train people in direct action and create a methodology where we do the workshops and we would train people to be their own clown, to find their own clown, but also to learn tactics of civil disobedience. So we would do things like go into recruitment agencies during the war, during the Iraq war, and we would just march in as the clown army and we would say, we want to join the army because we're really good at liberating people. We've heard you're liberating people in Iraq, so we've got lots of experience. We've been in the army for a long time, so we'd really like to join. But we'd do it in the most stupid way. And, of course, then they'd have to shut down the agency, and we managed to shut them down for a day. And then we'd set up our really bad, shitty recruitment stall for the clown army outside. It's interesting. If any of you have been looking at the press and the media, we've just had 5 undercover police officers discovered in our movements over the last 10 years in England. This is one of them. She's called Lynn Watson, and she was the worst clown ever. So the other thing about the clown army was it had a kind of a deeper psychological work involved in it. My experience of activism is that a lot of activists, you get involved in activism because you feel something deeply in your body. You sense it. It comes back to the aesthetics. You sense it in your body. You get involved. You maybe start to do more research. You realize, oh, shit, the injustice that you were interested in, you realize it connects to all the other injustices in the world. And then you start to kind of work, and then you start to get repressed by the police. And then maybe you start to lose all your friends because your critique becomes more and more radical and you can only really talk to radicals anymore. And then you kind of slowly build up armor. You slowly build up this kind of armor of against feeling. So you begin by feeling and you end by not feeling. And for me, the disaster of a social movement is to have a social movement made up of coats of armor who don't feel. Because when you don't feel, you make mistakes, you don't feel other people's needs. And fundamentally, freedom for me is understanding the needs of the other. You know, that's what freedom is about. So if you can't feel, then how can you understand the needs of the other? So the clown army idea was the clown is a very interesting character because clown training involves ripping off the armor, and actually a clown has not even skin. The clown feels everything directly. The clown is a kind of... It's related to the shamanic character, and it really is a figure that is neither male nor female, neither stupid nor funny, nor wise, neither scary or friendly. It's this kind of very strange in between character who has no skin. So the idea of the training was very much to get activists to feel again through the clown training. And what it would do is create really unexpected forms. The police didn't really know how to deal with it at first. Now they do, but and so there were some really lovely moments. This was a clown who she would put lipstick on, then she would kiss the riot shield, and then she would put more lipstick and kiss. And so in the end, all the riot shields were just covered in kisses, and the riot police actually moved away afterwards, which was really the magic of clowning. There were some moments of magic that I don't know how to rationally explain how that happened, actually. So the other good thing about clowning is that you're a trickster. You can change shape. And we managed to lie to the Ministry of Culture and say we were a kind of traveling theatre company and we needed £24,000 to travel around the country to do trainings in rebel clowning. And so we managed to get the money, and we didn't tell them that we were ending at the G8, and we basically did a 9-city recruitment tour. And so we pulled this caravan all the way. No, we did. We had a bus. We did shows in different public spaces, and loads of different people came. It was interesting. At one point, the Scotland Yard rang the the kind of arts officer of this borough, this little municipality in London, and the Scotland Yard rang her, and she's just the arts officer, and she said hello, and they went, oh, Scotland Yard, and she went, oh, hello, and they said, did you know that they're not a normal travelling theatre company, you know? And they said, you have to look, if you Google Big Shoe Camp, you'll see what they're really about. Which was quite interesting. I mean, she then freaked out, rang me. But what was interesting, we then had a long conversation about the role of disobedience and direct action, and that everything we take for granted comes from that. And she came to the show and loved it, and it was great. So we did the shows, and during the shows, we had radical origami lessons, where we would make these started on as hearts, and then they became D for disobedience instead of D for dunce. And then those also became megaphones, and then you could turn them upside down, and they became chip cones, and we gave free chips. If you ever want people to come to your show, give them free chips. You turn up in a town, you say free chips, dozens of people come. It's incredible. It doesn't matter how bad the show is, really. And then after the show, we would do a two-day workshop with local activists and local artists and so on, and do the training in rebel clowning. And then we then had an exhibition in an art gallery where we invited people to plan their attack with the clown army on the G8. So it was kind of a war room. And the plan was to so people could touch this and all move it around, and the plan was to make the fences higher around the G8 to say, well, they should stay in the hotel because they're dangerous, and we should make the fences higher. And we managed to recruit about 200 clowns, which was great. And we got up to the G8, and we did a whole series. So this is in 2006. I think seven. I can't remember when it was in London, in Scotland. And then on the day that, you know, all the papers were like, anarchists coming to town, they're going to eat your babies. On that day, we were doing a load of different actions, blocking the delegates' coaches and so on. And then one group of clowns, a small group who had split off from the big group, met a load of police on a bridge, and this is what happened. Shit, it's the best video ever. That's never happened. Hang on. Oh, am I talking too fast? Sorry. Okay. Okay, I'm going to just... Oh, fuck. Sorry. I don't know. I think when we changed all the movies things, it's reset the movies, which is really annoying. Just wait with me. Sorry. I think when we changed the computers, talk amongst yourself, do some clown exercises, whatever you want to do.
We need to explain.
Right.
We haven't quite got it. If we win the same, we have to hug.
Okay.
Back a bit.
Give them a chance. They're right. The beginners. Come on.
Yeah, I've been on this before.
Okay. 1, 2, 3.
So anyone who did the workshop will know what was happening there. So basically, it's a game a bit like Paper, Scissors, Stone, but where the where you use your entire body. So either I'm not sure if this happened before or after that game, but the Clan Army then had the great honor of being on the front homepage of NECTU, which is the National Extremist Tactical Coordination Unit, which is to promote and coordinate responses to domestic extremism by providing tactical advice to the police service. So we were their homepage picture. Quite interesting, I think. They know the power of the clown. So they've now changed it to motorbikes. So tactic number six, don't pretend to do politics. My friend and art critic Brian Holmes writes, basically what I have to say here is simple. When people talk about politics in an artistic frame, they're lying. So when I say we, the collective that I'm working in now, called the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination, we were invited to the Tate Gallery, the Tate Modern in London, to do a workshop. And they invited us to do a workshop on art and activism. So we said, yes, that's great. And we decided to call the workshop Disobedience Makes History, because it was planned to be around 89, the anniversary of 89. And in the end, it happened in 2010, but it was planned to be 89. Anniversary. So they put it on the front page of their website. They were very, very proud to have, you know, art activism in the Tate. And it was going to be 2 days of workshop open to the public and then an intervention, a public space intervention at the end coming out of the workshop. And then I get an email from them, which is like, oh, yeah, we're just sorting out the coffee, da 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 da. It's great. The workshop's sold out. We're really happy. Oh, yeah. And just, we just wanted to say that. It's also important to be aware that we cannot host any activism directed against Tate and its sponsors. However, we very much welcome and encourage a debate and reflection on the relationship between art and activism. Now, in England, in English, we have a term, a red rag to the bull, which means, I don't know if it works here, but it means when you put a red rag and the bull charges. This was a bit of a red rag. So obviously they were interested in discussion. The question is, who are the Tate sponsors? Well, it's BP, in fact, British Petroleum. And now in London, if you want to see all the cultural institutions that are funded by either BP and Shell, this is all of them. Everything. Alder Media, Tate, Royal Opera House, British Museum, Natural History Museum, National Gallery, National Maritime Museum, everything is sponsored by the oil companies. Why do they sponsor them? Well, in fact, what we say is not, they don't sponsor them. The cultural institutions help them create a clean image, basically. It's basically, they give the cultural institutions cultural capital to be seen as progressive. So the companies are seen as progressive companies and not ecocidal, genocidal organizations, which is what they are. So we all went and had the workshop. And we did some work, and then after about an hour of work with people, I gave a talk about artists and disobedience, because it was called Disobedience Makes History, and I projected the email on the wall, and the person who wrote the email was in the room. I didn't say it was her, but I said, okay, to the students, I said, we've had this email from the Tate. Do we obey it, or do we not obey it? And we did a spectrum line. Those who were in the workshop will know what a spectrum line is. And to see if we were going to disobey the email. And the great thing is, after much discussion, we decided to disobey the email. And a whole load of actions came out of that. Including weeks later, there was a 20th anniversary celebration of BP sponsorship of the Tate. And a great vernissage of Fiona Banner's work. And we turned up and poured molasses and feathers all over the entrance, shut down the entrance of the Tate, and then had two people inside the Tate with big dresses. And under their dresses, they had big bags with strap-on, attached with kind of dildo strap-ons, big bags. And then they cut the bags and let the oil go all over the inside of the museum. And it was wonderful. And it got enormous media coverage, and the debate about sponsorship and oil and culture was all over the media and all over, quite global. There was articles in Germany and Australia and United States and so on. So, don't pretend to do politics. If you're asked to do politics in the museum, get prepared to give away your cultural capital. Because I'm never going to be invited to the Tate again, that's for sure. Now, it would be really nice to say that that was something that happened rarely. But no, it happens all the time. And just a few months before, we had been in, or afterwards, I can't remember, I lose track of time, the Nicolai Center for Contemporary Art in Copenhagen had invited us and said, great, the climate change UN conference is happening. We're doing an event on art and politics and climate change. We'd like you to do something. So we said, okay, great. We'll do a project called Put the Fun Between Your Legs, Become the Bike Block. And the idea was that we would transform bicycles into tools of civil disobedience. There was the word civil disobedience in the proposal about 7 times. They read the proposal, they said, yes, it's great. They commissioned it. 5 weeks later, they rang me and said, oh, it's great, we've been talking to the police. And the police say, in Denmark, there are very particular rules about what is a bicycle and what is not a bicycle. Okay? So a bicycle has to be 2 meters, no more than 2.5 meters long, no more than 1.5 meters wide, no more than 3 wheels. I was like, well, it doesn't really matter whether the bikes are legal or not because we're going to take civil disobedience anyway, which is breaking the law. You know, it doesn't matter. And she was like, oh, you're going to break the law? I was like, yeah, you've seen our work. It says civil disobedience 7 times. So she had been really affected by the disease of representation. She said, you're really going to do it? So the lesson was we didn't do it with them. We went and we worked with a squat and a cultural center. And lesson number 7, create edges and doorway. Or tactic number 7, create edges and doorways. So we're at the heart of a lot of the work that we do at the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination is a philosophy called permaculture. The idea of permaculture is that if we observe the way an ecosystem works, we can learn enormous amounts of how to set up social systems. If we look at a forest or a meadow, we can see that they're very resilient, they're very productive, they're very diverse, and incredibly energy efficient. And so the idea of permaculture is to learn from ecosystems, the way ecosystems work, and apply that design principles to our systems. Now, one thing in permaculture is the importance of the edge. And as artists, I think it's a really interesting thing to create edges. An edge between a forest and a meadow is where there are the most numbers of relationships between different species. So there's the most amount of communication happening between different species. And as a result, there's the most amount of evolution happening. So it's the most creative part of an ecosystem is the edge. It's the same with the seashore. The edge between sea and land. So for us in the lab, we try to create edges all the time.
Aufgrund von Urheberrechten ist dieser Teil in der Podcast-Version leider rausgeschnitten.
So the edge that we wanted to create in Copenhagen was the edge between activists doing the reclaim power actions against the UN and the corporations and the kind of government stitch-up of the talks. And also an edge between people who are interested in bicycles, who liked bicycles, and artists. And the idea really was to create a window into radical politics. There's a lot of the work we do is a window into radical politics or a doorway into radical politics. So a lot of people got involved in the bike block because they love bikes, not because they love radical politics necessarily. The same with the clowns. A lot of people went into the clown because they like performing, they like clowns, not because they like radical politics. And for us, it's very much about opening those doorways and those edges. So the bike block, we collected 500 bikes from the streets of Copenhagen, because the other thing in permaculture is use your local resource. use the resource that is there, and there are hundreds of bikes left. Does anyone know why the Danish leave their bikes everywhere? It's a real mystery to me. It's the only city in the world where that really happens. And so the idea was to build these tools of civil disobedience using bikes. And so we were in the candy factory, which was a kind of part of a DIY squat culture place, incredible place. And we created loads of different tools. One of them was this, which is called the Double Double Trouble. It's four bikes together. You can carry stuff into an action, but you can also, you're higher than the crowd, so you can look over the crowd, you can see what's going on. It's quite maneuverable. It's beautiful. Unfortunately, the police came into the space the day before and took them all away in a very, very big lorry and put the front page of the papers the next day was that the police had found the war bikes. And then we basically did loads of trainings. We mended about 200 bikes, and we realized that the best way was swarming. So we did loads of trainings with about 150 people, 200 people, and then went and did the action and used the bikes for barricades, for throwing under police cars when the police cars were coming, for doing all different kinds of actions. But the most important thing in all our work is actually the power of rebel friendship. Because everything we do is always through consensus, without hierarchy, and is always to try and create convivial spaces. And for us, it's about friendship. Fundamentally, it's about the pleasure that's had in friendship in creating those groups. Okay, number 8. We're nearly done. We've got only 11. So, performing post-capitalism. How do we create moments where people can taste post-capitalism? Can taste and feel what post-capitalism might look like. Of course, we'll never know exactly what it will look like because we can never imagine it right now. But we can at least create some tasters to what it could be like. And for me, one of the movements that is most interesting that we have worked with a lot is the climate camp in England. There's also climate camps in Germany, in France, in different countries. And what's really interesting about the climate camp is it does two things. And for me, social change is like there's a DNA strand in social change, like these two bits of DNA that have to come together. One of them is present the alternative, present what post-capitalism could look like, and at the same time resist the suicide machine, and to try and do those two things in the same moment. Because if you split them off, what happens is the alternatives can become laboratories for capital. They can be laboratories for new forms of capitalism, laboratories for new forms of thinking that can be co-opted very quickly. So the climate camp is brilliant in that it does these two things. So what we do is we go and we squat a piece of land next to a power station or where they're going to build a runway or some kind of climate criminal. We squat the land and we create a self-managed eco-village for about 2,000 people. The village, the idea of the village is that we have a slogan which is like, everyone is crew. Everyone is crew. So everyone participates in the building of the village and everyone participates in the running of the village in big assemblies. And it's cut down into neighborhoods, a bit like the No Borders camp. The idea was taken from the No Borders camp I think the first time it was in Strasbourg many years ago. So that each neighborhood is from a different area of Britain. So there's the London neighborhood, the Scotland neighborhood, the North neighborhood, and each neighborhood is surrounded by a kitchen, but everything is run by renewable power. This is the media center, which is run by bike power. There's a TV station, a live running TV station, and this is all in a field, and it's all been set up without permission by the police overnight. I mean, it's quite a logistical miracle, really. All the water is using plants to wash the water, ecological systems of water wastage, and we do workshops. So there's 100 during the week. There's 125 workshops, and the idea is education, alternatives, and direct action. And so the education is there's about 125 workshops on everything from how to build a wind turbine to the science of climate change to how to take direct action and so on. And then there's a direct action. One of the direct actions that the lab helped produce was this, where we built shields out. We knew we had to go through a police line, so we built these shields, and each shield on the image on the front of the shield was an image of someone, a portrait of someone who was going to be affected by climate change in some way, in somewhere in the world. And then, of course, when we went through the police lines, and we did get through the police line, the image in the media was of the police smashing the faces on the shields, in a sense, which was a great image. And then we do a load of actions. This is a very English-style action. I don't know if you do this here. It's using super glue, and you super glue your body to... She's super gluing her body to the Department of Transport. And it takes about 4 hours for them to... They have to bring the medics, and they have to wash it all off, and... It's, you know, you can put a, instead of carrying a D-lock around with you to lock something, you can put a super glue in your pocket and spontaneously lock yourself to anything. So, 9, make passionate adventures. Changing the world has to feel like an adventure. It really has to feel like an adventure. If it's not an adventure and it doesn't create our passion, it doesn't touch our passion, I think we might as well just go home, really. So a project we did during the climate camp was also, the lab was called the Great Rebel Raft Regatta, the GRR. And the idea of the GRR was that we buried, we had two bits of the GRR. We had Project IKEA and we had Project Treasure Island. And Project Treasure Island, we buried 10 boats under the earth in a forest. And then we gave people treasure maps. And the treasure map showed them where the boat was, and the boat was also buried with a bottle of rum. And so people would go into the woods, they would dig up their boat, and then at a certain time, all at the same time, everyone took the boat and put the boat onto the river, and we got about 123 people onto the river. And the idea was that the boats would try and block a power station, a coal-fired power station. And actually, one of the boats did manage to block the entrance of the power station and shut down a third of the power station. But the most important thing was people had such fun doing it, that it really, you know, it was the adventure. And again, as artists, I think we're very good at imagining and creating and enabling adventure. 10. Only 2 more to go. Cultivate the unexpected. So history is completely unexpected. If I'd been standing on the stage 3-4 weeks ago and said, oh yeah, there's going to be this revolution across the Arab world and it's all going to be set off because one guy set himself alight, everyone would have laughed. You know, it was totally unexpected. And I think we can see that most historical change happens in very unexpected moments, and that actual whole systems can collapse very, very quickly, as you experienced in 89 in this part of the world. Interestingly enough, in 89, when doing the anniversary of 89, the 20th anniversary, the BBC did a very interesting study across the globe. And they looked at they looked at 27 countries, and they asked, was capitalism working well? Now, how many percent of the world, of those 27 countries, do you think thought capitalism was working well? How many percent? Come on, I guess. Come on. It's like a market. 20%. No, less than 20% of the world think that capitalism is working well. Huh? 8%. Oh, a bit more than 8%. 12, or tiny bit less, 11%. 11% of the world think capitalism is working well. And nearly 1 in 4, so 1 out of 4, said that they thought it was a fatally flawed system and that another economic system was needed to replace it. These are kind of statistics that we don't hear very often. Now, what's the role of artists in all this? Well, this is 1980, in the early 80s, in Poland. It's a bunch of artists, anarchists, punks, hippies, all getting together in Poland. There's martial law in Poland. You're not allowed to go into the streets. You will be shot if you're in the streets. So they decide for weeks before to do graffiti all over the city, calling for a gnome action. And they're called the Orange Alternative, and they call for gnomes to come out onto the street. Thousands and thousands of young people come out onto the street, and they've made them orange hats. Orange hats to be gnomes, and they take to the street with slogans like "Down with Gargamel" or "King size for everyone." Seemingly totally unpolitical. But the reason that they are able to take to the street is because they're using the unexpected. They're not using what the state thinks is politics, thinks is political action. And there's a great book called The Carnival of the Revolution, which traces all these groups that his thesis is that these groups, like the Orange Alternative, opened up the public space that enabled 89 to happen. That it wasn't necessarily all the big unions and the big social forums, but actually that it was subcultural groups early on in the early 80s that opened up that space, and a lot of them being artist groups. And I think it's a very interesting part of history that we often forget. Ten. Oops. 11. Occasionally take holidays in representation. So, as I said, yes, we should be against representation. But as anyone knows, it's really hard work. You know, to be taking action all the time, to be organizing. There's something really nice and much easier about being in a representational position. So I do take holidays in representation. I took a holiday around 2002 and did a book called We Are Everywhere that has been translated into German and is published by Nautilus. And it's called We Are Everywhere, The Irresistible Rise of Global Anti-Capitalism. And that was a holiday in representation. But I've just finished another holiday in representation, which was my partner and I went on a journey across Europe, and we visited 11 utopian communities, post-capitalist communities. And it ranged from a permaculture community to an anarchist school, a free love community, occupied factories in Serbia, a squatted village in France, a village that the precarious agricultural workers had reclaimed all the land from the count, to Christiania, the free town in Copenhagen. So we went to about 11 places. And out of the project, last week it was launched in Paris, came this, which is a book and a film. So it's a book and it's also a film. And the idea is that the book is the documentary, that it's really about the story of these places and our experience traveling to these places and how they work and their history and a bit of critique. And the film is in the tradition of utopian literature. So it was filmed during the journey, but is a fiction, as if there's been an economic and ecological collapse of Europe, and this is now how people live. It's normal. So it's set in the future, but shot in the present. And for us, the whole idea of the book, in a way, is summed up by this beautiful phrase, which is from Mujeres Creando, who are an anarcho-feminist art group in Bolivia. And they say, be careful with the present that you create, because it should look like the future that you dream. And I'll just end by showing the trailer of the film, and then we can, if it's going to... No, it's not happy. Hang on.
C'est important. Et qu'on reste replié sur soi.
Yeah, okay, we're not.
Et puis ça risque de développer un esprit de forteresse. On prenne plus les autres ou on soit complètement en décalage. C'est intéressant d'être en interaction, d'être les deux, de faire une double démarche.
Okay. Forget it. No? Do you want to see it?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I'll just play it on there.
Yeah, we can also, I mean, we're going to try and show the movie, not this time, but soon in the Gängeviertel, the entire movie. But we're going to wait maybe till the book is translated into English, because now it's only available in French. And there's also no copy to sell today, sorry. But yeah, we definitely want to show the movie here soon. But now maybe we see the trailer?
Yeah.
Soon. In a second.
Aufgrund von Urheberrechten ist dieser Teil in der Podcast-Version leider rausgeschnitten.
Watch it online, it's online.
Yeah. And maybe it's a technical trick so people want to come back and see it, you know?
I don't know what's happening. Sorry. Thank you.
So, no, thank you very much. I think we still want to discuss, and maybe probably, hopefully there are a lot of questions, but I think we do a 5-minute break, take a drink, smoke a cigarette, and then I'll come back and discuss.
Im freien Senderkombinat hört ihr gerade die Sendung Die Kunst der direkten Aktion, eine Aufzeichnung vom 19. Februar diesen Jahres aus dem Hamburger Gängeviertel. Moderiert von Hanna Kowalski referierte John Jordan zur Kunst der direkten Aktion, begleitet von diversen Videoprojektionen. Nach einer Pause folgte eine Diskussion mit dem Publikum, die wir nun im Anschluss wiedergeben.
So, one more organizational thing is that the whole talk was, I forgot to say it in the beginning, the whole talk was recorded because all of our talks are, not like all of them in this row, are also sent at FSK, the Freie Senderkombinat of Hamburg. And so for the discussion, if someone doesn't want to be on FSK, if they don't want to be recorded, they should just not speak through the microphone. But for everyone else, we would be glad if they speak through the microphone, because otherwise it won't be recorded. And now I would like to just start, and I hope and I think probably that there are questions to John about the actions, and maybe also what we try to do this today on the workshop is to say, what does that mean for us? Because, I mean, in Hamburg we had a lot of creative actions, creative resistance actions in the last 2 years. Maybe not as impressive as some pictures we've seen right now. Maybe as impressive, who knows? Like, I mean, we're sitting in the Gängeviertel, which is impressive, I think. But, so I would just now... Are you there?
Yeah.
Are you settled?
I'm ready.
Are you ready? Ready for questions?
No.
No. Are there questions from the audience of all that we just heard about? Oh, there's just a hand. I'm happy.
Turn the projector off and put the lights up. Is that?
Yeah. Hello.
And put the lights up on the.
Oh,
so we can
it
see
works.
The audience.
Yeah. Okay. Hi. Thanks very much, first of all, for the talk. It was really, really interesting. I didn't know you at all before I came, and I'm glad I'm here. What I wanted to ask you, you alluded to the infiltration of certain groups in the UK. And I just want, and I assume it's not just limited to the UK, but worldwide. What's your response to that? How do you deal with it? How do you maintain trust in an organization and the people that you're working together with? Thanks.
I mean, it's a brilliant question. Trust is key. You know, I mean, I think building trust, and one of the techniques we do, you know, one reasons I, in our collective, we play a lot of games, is to develop trust about people. So I think it's the one thing that is the most important for social movements. In the UK, this whole thing about police has only happened over the last few months. Now, of course, we've known there are always undercover officers. We never quite realized how deep they were. I mean, as you probably read in the news, you know, one of them had a 5-year relationship with an activist. You know, they lived together, they were lovers for 5 years. At the moment, I think the way it's been dealt with by the movements is really brilliant, because the first thing is solidarity for people who've been affected, mostly women, because he also had many other lovers, including lovers in Germany. And there's another officer we've now found who also had lovers and blah. So the first thing was that it's actually shown a great level of solidarity as opposed to lack of trust in the movement. And that's been beautiful. And a lot of intelligence. It's then, you know, we then decided to go to the press and to make it a press story. And in fact, it's had to rechange. It became very embarrassing for the British state, that the fact that they were not only allowing their police officers to sexually violate people, basically, because that's what it is, but also that they were basically sending them abroad without even checking with the countries. So you had, you know, British police officers working in German movements without the German government even being told or properly. And so it's created a bit of embarrassment, and they are going to rework their policing of undercovers, you know. And they're still going to fucking do it. They're just going to have to be much better at it. I mean, one thing we have learned, actually, and this is useful to know, that there are definitely similarities with all of them. So one similarity is none of them like to talk about politics. That they're always action, doing stuff people. So that was kind of interesting to know, that they were never really had a very clear understanding of the politics, or never really wanted to talk about it. The other thing, lots of them were van drivers. Okay, so lots of them had jobs which made them indispensable for the movement. One of them did the accounts, for example, for a social centre. So interesting jobs that were kind of indispensable, but not everyone could do because of skill or whatever. And so, you know, I think we're still a bit in shock, and we don't know how we're going to deal with it, to be honest. So far, I think it's been dealt with really well, but we haven't really been planning big actions, so we've just been dealing with it. And there's now a big week meeting in England about with the climate camp movement, and to talk about strategy and so on, and we'll see. It's historically, it's always been the case, you know. In the 19th century, Chatterton wrote a novel about 19th century anarchism in London, and the novel is all about all the heads of all the anarchist movements were all spies, and they didn't know each other were spies, you know. So it's always happened. In some ways, it's a sign that we're doing something dangerous to the state, which I think is good to know. But I think we cannot let it break our trust. I think that's the key. And we have to find ways of organizing which are partly open and partly closed, and, you know. So we'll see. But I don't know if anyone here has experience of that thing or has suggestions of how to deal with it. I mean, the thing is to not let them fuck with your head, you know, really. And that's what that's what that kind of thing is meant to do. So we'll see. Maybe there'll be a less jumping into bed so easily as well, I think, you know.
No, it's very simple. Just about how you can, if you have problems, or how you deal with the financing of everything. Doing this, I mean, it's a lot of time and blah blah blah, and yeah.
Each action had different structures. I mean, I don't make my living doing this. That's for sure. I teach. I write. My partner has a full-time job at the university. I don't pay much rent, so, you know, there's no way I make my living. Sometimes we subvert things and try and get cultural funding money. Sometimes, like Reclaim the Streets, we never got cultural money from cultural funding, but, you know, like anywhere, like Gangavital, we'd do gigs and fundraise through gigs. We'd steal stuff, we'd borrow stuff, we'd, you know. But I think that, you know, I mean, I think it's... I was paid by the Tate. I thought they weren't going to pay me in the end, but they did. I was waiting for the moment, and then I was like, great, I hope they don't pay me, then I'll really take them to court. But they did pay me, yeah. which that money was then used. I used some of the money for myself, but I used some of the money to produce. We produced this publication that describes some of the events. So.
Hi, John. It's really, really impressive what you told, and you're really a great person, and really appreciate it. And my question is quite simple as well. How do you manage not to end up in prison for your entire life?
Anyone who's done direct action knows that you can get arrested loads of times and you don't end up in prison because you're not I'm talking about Britain. I don't know if that's the case in here, but you know, for doing blockades and that kind of stuff, you know, quite rarely does it go to court. Often these kind of actions in Britain, often they arrest hundreds of people and then they don't charge any. And then what's good, and come back to your question about money, you sue them. And I don't know if you can do that in Germany. But if you're wrongfully arrested in England, and it happens all the time, they wrongfully arrest you just to get you off the street, you can then sue them. And I have a friend who was one of the organizers of the Great Rebel Raft Regatta. He was arrested the day before the regatta, and I was like, oh no, he's gone, shit, how are we going to do the regatta? I can't believe he's been arrested. Anyway, I bumped into him a few days ago, and he just got £15,000 for that arrest because it was a wrongful arrest, and they hit him as well. So you can live on, you know, you can live for a year on one arrest. Not in Germany? Really? Okay. Okay. All right, yeah, okay. So, you know, also in movements, you know, there are so many different levels. You don't have to always be. Movements work because there are people doing different things. So if there are people doing the legal support or the cooking, or the, you know, loads of levels of organizing. Not everyone has to be frontline to be risking arrest. If everyone just wanted to be a frontline risking arrest, nothing would happen. You know, movements need everything. You know, need all the unsung heroes. You know, are doing more important work in a way. All the work to kind of enable the meetings to happen, the spaces, the food, the first aid, the support, the communications, the websites. All that is just as important. And you know. You don't get arrested so much.
Well, hello, John. Now, I would like to thank you for your presentation, which was really, really inspiring. And I would also like to ask you a question, of course. I come from this relatively small town in the Netherlands, which is like 5 hours from here. But the question mainly regards like the creativity in these actions, because I remember being a member of this relatively small activist. I mean, the town was also small, so we would be like 15 people. And then we would meet every week, and then we would think like, hell yeah, this is really evil, which is happening in our town. I don't know, they would try to build a new road or destroy a number of houses, or there was something with social security and blah, blah, blah. And then we would sort of like come together and say like, yeah, that's really an issue. We should take this up. What shall we do? And then, well, by that time, you know, the room was already very smoky because we were all, and then in the end, nobody really knew what to do. And then in the end, we said, well, yeah, let's do a demonstration, and we would make like placards, and then we would sort of like stand somewhere at the middle of a road for like an hour with these placards, and everybody would sort of like ignore us or not see us or whatnot, and it was of course always raining, and then we would go home and be sort of like semi-depressed because, you know, well, with the 15 of us, we never really got into this like sort of like super ideas of like, let's build a barricade in the middle of a road, or we also did not really have like the connections to sort of like start a climate camp. But like this idea, like how do you get people together and then sort of come to this idea, like let's do something completely different that gets either the authorities or the establishment or the police off their feet. How does this happen? Like this. Okay, it's a bit, but it's, you know where I'm headed for.
Yeah. What were you smoking? Maybe you're smoking the wrong stuff. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I suppose it comes really from the problem. It starts with a problem. It starts with really realizing that demonstrations, really feeling that demonstrations don't do anything, even if you have a million people. I mean, we had a million people on the streets of London during the war, and you know, they still went to war. So it starts with confronting that problem and going, well, we absolutely are not going to do a demonstration, and then just sitting and spending time and playing and taking the risk of being stupid. I think taking the risk of failing and also taking the risk of making a fool of yourself, I think, is important as well. And maybe just allowing loads of stupid ideas to come in and you know, doing brainstorming, using techniques in the meetings where maybe you're not just all sitting down. Because I think sitting down on a chair, trying to have ideas, it kind of works, but there's more efficient ways of doing it. So, you know, using big bits of paper, drawing, getting people to run around with their bodies and maybe do, you know, games, or just breaking out that kind of sitting down spirit, I think also helps. I don't know if that's the kind of answer. I think, I don't know if anyone else, you know, there's lots of creative techniques that you can try and use for the process. But I think sitting in a circle doesn't help, really, very often, you know. I don't know, is that at all an answer? It's an answer.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, we're just in this very interesting moment where we start to think about the question, where comes creativity from? I don't know. I would like to go back to this question we had before, the money issue, because in a way, if you look at the relationship between art and politics, and then also start to think about how do I make my living, and if you're from the world of art, it's what you described with the Tate Gallery example so well, the risk of kind of falling into the traps of the art market are so dangerous in a way. Or look at the Gängeviertel. I mean, people work every day for this artwork, if you want to call it that way, which is also political work. But how do they make their money? And where does it come from? And it's so easy, especially if you are from the art world, to go back to this representational work just to make your money, because at least you can go for grants and so forth. Yeah, it's just more a comment or a question, really.
I mean, you know, there is not one answer. There are many, many different answers depending on context and depending on many things. I mean, I think what Boyce did was interesting in a way, full of problems, but you know, using the art market to fund other things, you know, using representation to fund other stuff, you know, obviously not everyone can get to the level of the market that Joseph Beuys did, but I think, you know, I think there is possibilities of doing that. I think that's quite an interesting way of doing it, you know, of using that to fund activities, actions. I think the key for me is the danger of cultural capital is very addictive. You know, that once you gain cultural capital, so I'm not talking about financial capital here, but actually the cultural capital. So if you do that, start to work in the art market to get money to do maybe the more interesting things, it's very easy, I think, to just get sucked into that, and because you want to continue your cultural capital. And I think the hardest thing is actually really sometimes to just give up your, you know, be prepared to give up your cultural capital and be able to take risks and not, you know that you're not going to get invited or know you're not going to be funded again. I sometimes call it the bank robbing strategy, because bank robbers never rob the same bank twice. So if you rob, you know, you take the money from one place, you know you'll do exactly what you want from that place. And as soon as you realize that you're not doing what you really wanted to do because of your internal censorship, because, you know, it's always internal censorship. The Tate, BP never told the curator that, not to let do actions. It was absolutely her internal fear that they would lose their sponsorship if someone did something against them. So it was absolutely an internal fear. So, yeah, the minute you start to feel that internal fear, just be prepared to maybe not, that you won't maybe get the money again. And also, I think the key is also, you know, how do we reduce our costs of our own lives? I think that's also the question, you know. How do we absolutely reduce what we need? You know, how do we create our own economic systems where we have to reduce the amount of money that we need? I mean, some of the places we went to on our trip were incredible like that. One of them was a squatted center in Can Masdeo, it's called, in on the edges of Barcelona. And they live for €1.50 a day there, which is pretty good, you know? So if you, you know, so there are, it's not easy, it's hard, and but I think that's the other work, you know, not just think, okay, we've got to just find a way of making money to live. It's also, how do we live with the least amount of money? But not, and it shouldn't be about sacrifice and living with a hair shirt and just drinking water and rice, you know, of course. But I think that's also the other question. Getting to know rich people. We got to know a millionaire. Very useful. You know, yeah. And in the art world, there are plenty of millionaires. So, you know, go and seduce millionaires. Better than seducing police officers, I think. I mean, there was a millionaire who helped fund some of the projects we did, and, you know, it was great. You know, there are a lot of guilty rich people out there who are feeling really guilty, and they don't want to, you know, they want to... So that's another... Any other ideas? Bank robbing. It's harder these days, but...
Maybe, like, I think we should... come to the informal part of the evening soon, so everyone that still has a question should think about it really fast, and then and then we'll soon go and drink and talk, and yeah.
Second question for me, it's kind of a big decision, I guess, to spend your life like this, and I really do fear I will end up like you, and the question is, for me, what difficulties about this being arrested and not have that much money, is this decision, do you know, how does it influence your life? It has to be hard, isn't it?
No. It's great. I wouldn't want another life, really. I feel really privileged, actually, that I'm surrounded by an amazing community of people who share a passionate engagement with the world. You know, for me, in the end, it's about passion. I'm very influenced by a 19th century utopian called Charles Fourier. And Fourier talked about the... He wanted a... And he was... You know, many people... No, I could talk for an hour about Fourier. I won't. But he talked about an economy or world system based on passionate attraction. That we should have an economy where people base their lives on what they're attracted to and the people they're attracted to. So the activity, everyone has a passion for an activity, and everyone has a passion for certain people. And I do feel in the social movements, which of course are hard and annoying and hard work and so on, but often it's the wonder is that you're with people who've chosen how they want to live their lives in the world and try and make that happen. You know, and I'm sure people in Gangavirtal have that. Even when it's really hard and it's hard work, you know that you're with people who share that passion. For me, that has more value than any kind of, you know, any capital or whatever.
Okay, how to go on with this creative resistance here in Hamburg?
You're asking me the question?
No, the whole audience.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't answer. I've been here for... I spent some time in the summer, but yeah.
So maybe that would be more a question for the next debate. I mean, it's a big one. Does anyone have an answer? I would like to hear it. It's also one of my questions. But so we do an extra day for that, right?
Hi. Maybe that's a comment on the question. It's not a question. It's just an observation. I've been working with a group called Schwabengard Ballett here from Hamburg. We've been doing like some activist things, and to sum up the experiences, you can either do an action where you have the critical mass already there, like a border camp or a whatever, anti-globalization summit. So you intervene, you create a frame, like you say, and you know, have a good idea about how to irritate the confrontation lines and stuff like that. Or you can do something like you did with Reclaim the Streets, you know, be 50 people or 100 people or 200 people, do an action, create media attention, get your message through. But the ideal, the utopia would be how to create an action that creates a movement, you know, or that helps to create a movement, or that stays there for longer than just, you know, the summit or the you know, the half an hour or the 2 hours you're on the street. So and I think this that's just one idea that pops up. And that's what we try to do here in Hamburg with the Right to the City movement. We try to create spaces like the Gängeviertel, because when you're in a space, either you squat a space or you don't leave when they want you to leave, you can invite people. People come up, can join the cause, can build up things, and you're stronger, you're more powerful. If you're within a space, if you have a room, a house, or even 12 houses like here in the Gängeviertel. So, because otherwise, I always fear that some sort of professional activism comes around where you travel around, you know, have a project here, a project there, but are not really localized and don't really work with people who are not able to do it 24/7, you know? So that's a little comment on what we just saw. Thank you very much.
No, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I also think there are people who are good at both things. You know, not everyone is good at all those things. You know, and I think that's something also to kind of look at is some people are really good at the long term. You know, that they stay in their locality, keep working and organizing and over the long term. Like, I'm really bad at that. Really, you know, I don't know. My personality is to go and always do a new thing and set it up. And I think there are people like me who are like butterflies who like to jump and round and create kind of inspiration and then disappear and inspiration. And I think we need both in a way. I definitely think we absolutely, you know, you have to have both. That you're not, a movement won't exist with just one of those two things. Any other questions?
There's one more.
Yeah. Hi, John. You were talking about post-capitalism, and as far as I've seen your work now, you and your friends make like quite spectacular actions. Like, they pop up and you do something very impressive, like a show, like a spectacle, and then you go on make the next problems. But as far as I've seen it with capitalism, there's the one of the biggest points is how we work. The most people are forced to work and to make their living, and not like artists, like more with more freedom. But most people have to go to to like labor and everyday stuff. And this is quite necessary for everyone. And you didn't deal with that problem, which is like the basic for capitalism, and
how to deal with wage labor.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, the work doesn't deal with wage labour, it doesn't deal with racism, it doesn't deal with lots of issues, I think, that are fundamental to our culture. How to answer that question? I mean, there are people I know who are doing really interesting work around wage labour, around precarity and stuff, like there's a group in London at the moment called the Precarious Workers Brigade, or the Carrot Workers, they're also called. And the idea of the Carrot Worker is that they work a lot within cultural institutions that do internships. So they try and really show how culture is based on free labour, not even wage labour, so absolutely exploitative labour without wages on the intern, and that's the carrot. So the idea that the interns work in cultural institutions for the carrot because they think they're going to get the jobs after. And so they're trying to unionise interns in the cultural industry. So there are people doing that kind of work and really looking at those questions. But yeah, I agree. I don't ever think that these actions are at all a solution. They're just 11 tactics that I've used to do certain things that, you know, there are millions of different ways of acting and doing, you know, post-capitalist kind of culture. You know, some can deal with ecology, some can deal with work, some can deal with sexism, racism, whatever. This is just one little segment of a much wider spectrum, I think. I think the one thing, though, is for me is to create convivial collective workspaces, so where people actually work together without hierarchy. And I think that is important in a sense, to show people that you can produce without hierarchy. You don't need hierarchy to produce. So you can produce, you know, you can remake 200 bikes and 15 double-double troubles collectively in a space over the period of, you know, 10 days without hierarchy, you know, actual production, you know, and a design, because it was also designed as well. So in that way, it for me, it has some little seeds of post-capitalist work structures to show that you can work without hierarchy. You know, the lack of hierarchy doesn't mean that it's chaos, doesn't mean that it's not productive, which is what the system tells us, you know, that if you don't have hierarchy, you're not going to be very efficient. I know that's a bit of a slimy, slidey answer, but...
But talking about work, I think you've been working in these rooms now since 11 o'clock in the morning, so I think it's time for ending it all. And is there any urgent question? Otherwise, I would just say thank you very much, and I hope that you'll be in Hamburg again.
It'll be a pleasure.
Yeah. And I think that's it.
In den letzten 2 Stunden hörtet ihr den 4. und vorerst letzten Teil der Diskussionsreihe Wir gestalten die Stadt, in der wir leben wollen, aber wie aus dem Hamburger Gängeviertel. Am 19. Februar 2011 war das Londoner Lab of II für einen Workshop zu kreativem Widerstand und für einen Vortrag im Gängeviertel. Letzteren hörtet ihr in den vergangenen 2 Stunden, moderiert von Hannah Kowalski, referierte John Jordan zur Kunst der direkten Aktion, begleitet von diversen Videoprojektionen. Im Anschluss folgte eine offene Diskussion mit dem Publikum. Diese Sendung ist bereits oder wird in Kürze über die FSK-Internetseite fsk-hh.org und über das Audioportal der Freien Radios freieradios.net zum kostenlosen Download zu finden sein. Dort findet ihr auch die ersten 3 Teile dieser und einige andere der vorangegangenen Reihen. Eine Sendung der Redaktion 3 zu erreichen über das freie Senderkombinat Eimsbütteler Chaussee 21 20 259 Hamburg oder per E-Mail an redaktion3@fsk-hh.org.